This is Last Wild Places, a Patagon Journal podcast where adventurers, conservationists, and other inspiring guests share their stories about nature's last frontiers. Hello everyone, my name's Lily Alford. Thank you for joining us for our first ever episode of Last Wild Places.
And I'm Jimmy Langman, the executive editor of Patagon Journal. In this podcast, we will be exploring wild places around the world from a variety of perspectives: conservation, science, expeditions, adventure, indigenous culture, outdoor sports, and more.
Our first guest is Amy Lewis, CEO of the Wild Foundation, an NGO that for 50 years has been mobilizing international coalitions for the protection of wilderness through the World Wilderness Congress, the Nature's Half Campaign, and other initiatives. It works in more than 40 countries, including on the ground in Mali, working to protect West African elephants, and in the Amazon, helping to defend the indigenous rights of the Yawanawa people. Amy is a key leader in the global movement to protect the world's last wild places, so we think she's the perfect guest to kick off the podcast.
Each episode also includes the backstory, where we talk to the writers of each issue of Patagon Journal to get a deeper perspective on their stories. In today's backstory, Victoria Trassler speaks with Paula Lopez Wood about her article, The Last Gauchos of Aysén, the cover story of issue 27. We hope you enjoy this episode. Well, hello, Amy. Thanks for joining us on Last Wild Places podcast. We're very honored to have you with us. You're actually our first guest. So this is a pretty special occasion, and it's on Global Rewilding Day, no less, so a doubly special occasion. How did you get involved with wilderness issues? What brought you into the wilderness movement, into the Wild Foundation?
Thanks for the question, Jimmy. So my background is actually in social movement building, and as both a practitioner and a scholar. With an international relations kind of focus. And the issues I'd always worked on earlier in my career were related to human rights and immigration and things like that. But it was really while being a community organizer during Hurricane Katrina that was kind of this watershed moment for me that really opened my eyes to the way that human welfare was so intimately connected with the natural world. So I was kind of recruited back into a graduate program for environmental policy. And my focus on that was, again, social movement movements and really around pollinator decline and pesticides, not really wilderness. And I was really happy in academia. I liked teaching. I liked research. But one thing that really dissatisfied me is that this feels like such a dynamic moment in our history. And I recognized that if I was lucky as a scholar, my ideas might filter out into the mainstream and become things that were driving strategy and policy, you know, two or three decades from now. And the job at the Wild Foundation opened up, and it was kind of, it felt really right. I took it. I've been with the Wild Foundation in varying capacities for the last 8 years, since 2015, 9 years, I guess now. And it's been a steep learning curve for me, because wilderness is, it's a subset of the environmental movement, but it's not the same. And I think that there's actually really significant differences that actually, if we embrace those differences and we really go deep in the wilderness movement, there's something really radical and transformational about the idea of wilderness and what it tells us about ourselves and our potential for our relationship with nature. And so I'm actually really excited to be in this movement because of that, and to be working at what I consider to be a slightly deeper level than I would have been if I was merely staying with like pesticides and agricultural policy and things like that.
How has wilderness affected you personally, and how has it changed your outlook on the world?
Well, you know, I've always kind of taken wilderness for granted. I grew up in Southern California. Every summer we would take camping trips into the Sierra Nevadas, where I'd be surrounded by these incredible trees, sequoias. I think like their Southern Hemisphere equivalent is the Alerce tree. So it was always a part of my life, and it was something I never really considered being without. And those moments for me in my childhood were healing moments. They were medicinal moments for me without me even really being able to articulate it. But looking back, like knowing exactly what I was experiencing and being able to put words to it. So, I mean, from as a child of North America with all of this land and all of these wild places around me, I feel like I grew up with that just embedded in me. Now returning to wilderness from kind of a conceptual place and a policy place, it's impacting me in no less of a profound way, but perhaps just in a much more conscious way, in that I now view wilderness as essentially inseparable from the human spirit as we know it. And I see that working at a societal level, and I also see that working in my own life, where I acknowledge and recognize that some of the traits I like best about myself were bestowed upon me by the wild. Maybe not in my lifetime, but they are instincts and they are capacities that were granted to me through ancestors who were living and adapted to the wild. So I see wilderness as an essential part of who we are and who I am.
Do you spend a lot of time outdoors, or do you do any hiking? Or
not as much time as I would like. I used to, up until about a year ago, I was climbing 14ers. I know, nothing like you have down in Chile. But I was climbing 14ers here in Colorado quite frequently, 14,000 foot mountains. That's over 4,000 meters. Going camping in the winter and camping in the summer. This last year has been a little busy, so I haven't gotten out as much as I would like to, but you know, my partner's from Chile. We went scuba diving actually in Belize just for fun. We hardly ever just do anything for fun. In November of last year, he was actually attacked by a shark. It was really bizarre. He's fine. It was all fine. But in, you know, the sharks are actually, they're just so incredible. They're so, like, you're in the presence, you're in the physical presence of like the guardians of these reefs. And so they're just amazing to be around. I think that the little incident we had is largely caused by the tour companies that have been chumming the water to get the sharks to come up for the tour boat. So now sharks are getting habituated to humans being food. And when we don't give them food, they're very disappointed.
You can hear in the way that you're speaking, you have this connection with your consciousness around those experiences. And you spoke earlier about a watershed moment. When you look back at your memories now, do you remember your childlike innocence, or do you view it through that kind of conscious kind of thing which you've encountered now?
I mean, it's a really good question. And I think there's been there's a lot more scientific exploration around the concept of consciousness, human consciousness, in the last few years, which is really interesting. And I feel like a child in the face of my own consciousness. I know that there's like this tip of the iceberg that I'm conscious of, and there's this whole world of unknown unknowns. So I don't feel qualified, but I will say that I live in my head a lot. I live in a conceptual space a lot, and I'm not always aware of what I'm thinking or feeling in the moment. But being in a wild place and being around undomesticated life forms instantly puts me back into my body. And it's such that that's a spiritual experience for me. It instantly makes me more aware of the immediacy of the moment and my surroundings. And it's such a beautiful, like it almost brings tears to my eyes when it happens, because I feel like I live so much in the past and in the future and in concepts and ideas. And then suddenly I'm living in my body, because whatever it is, those primal responses, like whether it's a fear response, a fight or flight response, but it's actually a joy experiencing that too. Cause I'm like, oh, here I am. And this is real. This is what it's all about. So
tell us about the Wild Foundation. What kinds of things are you guys working on right now? I know you have the 12th Wilderness Congress coming up.
So yeah, our flagship program has always been the World Wilderness Congress since the 1970s. And that is to really mobilize a global wilderness movement. It started actually in South Africa by a white South African game ranger, Ian Player, and his Zulu mentor, Makubu Ntumbela. And they helped bring the southern white rhino back from the brink of extinction. I think it's the first time that a charismatic megafauna had been taken off of the IUCN endangered species list because it had been saved. But it was Makubu Ntumbela who recognized that we can go around and save species by species and win a lot of battles, but lose the war. Because the war is a broken relationship with nature. And when Makubu had this insight and kind of these four sister organizations that now make up Wilderness Foundation Global, WILD is one of them, were kind of starting to be conceived of by Ian and Makubu, they went out into the bush in search of a symbol for this movement and these organizations. And they spent like days out there and nothing struck them as right. But as soon as they came home from the bush, they walked up to Makubu's kraal and he bent down and he picked up a leaf off of the ground that basically grows on every single kraal in South Africa. It's the Erythrina leaf. It's a very common thing. And he held it up to Ian. He said, "This is the symbol of our movement because wilderness is our home." And so from the beginning, we have had, I think, maybe a somewhat different conception of wilderness than a lot, because a lot of people conceive of wilderness as something that's remote and something, you know, where humans like can visit, but they do not remain. But from the beginning, because of this kind of embedded indigenous knowledge, wilderness and wild places for us have been our home of our spirit, of our bodies, everything. And I think the World Wilderness Congress has worked very hard to embed that ethic institutionally, build out wilderness frameworks in countries that don't even have words for wilderness, and influence global agendas around the protection of wild places. So we're doing that now. For the first time, it's not being hosted by a national government. It's being hosted by a traditional indigenous government, the Ocheti Shakowin, the Seven Council Fires of the Lakota Nation in South Dakota, and that will be later this year. And we're really looking at exploring our roots of the World Wilderness Congress and really reinterpreting wilderness through indigenous perspectives. So there'll be indigenous leaders from around the world who are speaking, and we'll also be focusing on, as a part of that Congress, kind of beyond protected areas. Like, protected areas are an incredible way of keeping the planet wild, but they're not the only way. And in fact, indigenous peoples have been probably carrying out in an uncoordinated fashion the most ambitious wilderness conservation agenda of the last century, as much of the biodiversity, most of the biodiversity that remains is on indigenous lands. So how we can support, empower, and maintain traditional and healthy indigenous stewardship of wild places, I think, is a key to maintaining a wild biosphere in the future. So that's the first thing we're working on. And Nature Needs Half plays a big part of this. We're all about keeping at least half of Earth's land and seas intact. That's the scientific consensus. We have to maintain 50% of land and sea intact in order to not cross these tipping points and cross these ecological thresholds. where, you know, you suddenly have 40% of an ecosystem left, but it's only producing 15% of the ecological services. I think it's safe to say we're probably witnessing one of these thresholds right now in the Amazon. Wild has another project there, working closely with the Yawanawa people and their leadership council, Chief Toshka and their leadership council, around implementing their life plan, but also more recently, at their request, kind of training the communities in international ranger standards so that they're better able to surveil and monitor their territory and the biodiversity within it. And I think this is a pretty cutting edge program, and it's something that we're looking at replicating with other indigenous communities around the world. But there, I was just visiting there for a site visit last September, in the middle of the dry season, and the elders, you know, their community is along the Rio Gregorio in the Western Amazon, and their elders were saying they've never seen the river as low as it is. And I had been there earlier in the year too, during the rainy season, and the river was full, and I saw river dolphins. It was wonderful. I get back there, and there are places where the river was down to less than 6 inches. And this river is their primary protein source. So that immediately wipes out their food security. But also, according to the elders, it was unprecedented what was happening. And there's a drought in the southern Amazon, in southern Brazil, in northern Argentina and Uruguay. So it's, and that's, I think it's safe to say that this drought is being caused by a threshold having been at least approached, if not crossed, in the Amazon. In the Amazon, a climate threshold, but also this is a biodiversity one. The Amazon has lost enough trees at this point in time. It's probably not producing as much rain as it has in the past. And the Amazon produces 70% of the rain for South America. And I think we may be seeing the beginning of the trend where South America receives far less rain because there's a lot less forest there to produce that rain.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, there's such a clear focus with Wild on indigenous stewardship. And I was quite interested to know about the process of reaching out to these communities and, as a result, what you've learned from these interactions.
Most of the communities that we're working with contacted us first and asked us for their help. It's rare, I think it would be really rare for us, or really unusual for us, to go into a place and say, we want to help you. That's really not the way we work. So we had a longstanding relationship with Chief Toshka, and this has evolved, especially with the political shifts that have occurred in Brazil. We want to make hay while the sun shines in Brazil. So the next 3 years for us are really important in terms of building up and supporting the Yawanawa. There's a project right now that we're developing with the Sami people. And that project kind of evolved because I did reach out to them initially to let them know about the World Wilderness Congress and how important we thought it was that the Sami were engaged in it. And then as they got to know us, I think they began to feel like they could trust us and that we could be partners. And so they began to talk about some of the obstacles they face in with the old growth forests and maintaining old growth forests and really intact wild areas for their reindeer herds. So we're looking at an old growth project potentially with them that could be coming online sooner rather than later. And we're also in the process of working with the hosts of the World Wilderness Congress on a longer term project about restoring the Great Plains at a landscape level through bison reintroduction. So bison are very different from cows and they have very different needs. But they're absolutely essential if we want to bring back the prairies. And prairies and grasslands are like the most degraded landscape on Earth. I think there's only 1 or 2% left that are intact. Right now, there's a lot of bison reintroduction efforts happening in North America, but they're happening at kind of this postage stamp scale where it's like a herd here and a herd there, and there's very little interconnectivity, and 1 + 1 is not adding up to the restoration of the prairies. Like, there's little pieces of prairie here and there, but it's not like you can go to this part of North America and say, okay, here's prairie now. So Wild and our Shichangu partners really want to look at, what is it going to take for us to restore the prairies at a regional scale, at a landscape scale? Interconnectivity, yes. Maybe new institutions, new models of ranching or of managing herds so that multiple stakeholders can benefit. And actually, the Sami have a really interesting and unique way of managing these huge herds of reindeer, like 50,000 reindeer, and, you know, at kind of a landscape level. So there are some institutional changes that may need to be made. There are certainly also some misinformation about bison and some public education that will have to occur to reduce opposition to bison reintroduction at a large scale. So we're pulling together partners right now, kind of as a part of the World Wilderness Congress, not to really do anything, like not to manage our own herd or manage a herd for the Shichangu Lakota, but to ease the barriers, lower the barriers to actually seeing herds become larger and more interconnected and bringing back the prairies at a regional scale.
Is there kind of an issue with, because you're talking about like the issue of building trust with Indigenous groups, how is that balancing when there is often quite a deep mistrust of national organizations and managing that so they can work together?
It's not easy, that's for sure. And ultimately, Wild's position is when there's a conflict, we defer to our Indigenous partners. We work for them, not the other way around. That being said, we work to manage and mitigate those conflicts and to create new pathways for trust. It's not easy and it's not perfect and it never will be. But having, I think, somebody there who they trust and for us having these relationships with federal agencies, national figures, that we trust, there's this like whole chain of trust that's involved to getting to that point. And, but ultimately it relies on the actors themselves. They have to come through with their commitments or they have to come through with benefits for Indigenous peoples if that relationship's going to move to the next level. So we do what we can to engage as many stakeholders as possible to try and get there. And there's some places, I think, and I will not name the country because they actually have a pretty good environmental reputation, even though there are some things kind of under the surface that aren't great. But there are some places, I think, where the trust has been completely broken. And we are actually looking at ways of bypassing the national level and just making connections directly at the global level, so that the issues that are being experienced can be heard there and not be censored. And I've seen some national level actors do a very effective job at censoring their Indigenous voices concerned about environmental issues at a global level. So Wild, in one case at least, we're working right now to bypass that national government in order to create at least more global awareness around a specific issue.
Do you guys talk a lot to local governments, state governments, or get help with things like that? Or?
So in the past, our major focus has been global institutions like the IUCN and the United Nations, because when we're able to have a policy adopted there, that becomes a toehold for us to talk to national governments. We can say, you know, your national government is signed onto this treaty, or you're a member of the IUCN, and they just voted to do this. So as a national government, you should have a committee set up for this. You should be setting up objectives for how you're going to achieve this in the next 5 years. You know, that's been our toehold. I think increasingly now that we're really deepening our project in the Western Amazon, certainly we're talking to national entities in Brazil, including the Minister of Indigenous Peoples, also as well as Obama, their protected area management agency. But we're probably, it's tricky in the Great Plains. The region, the kind of provincial governments in the Great Plains are not they're not the most friendly to environmental stuff. But we are talking with the federal agencies across North America about this as well, and have engaged several people around it.
The national park idea, do you think that's still the main tool for protecting wild places? Or what are some of the ways that countries should be protecting wild places?
Well, there's seven categories of protected areas at the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. And national parks are actually category two. They're not considered the highest level of protection. Like, they're still, you still maintain a lot of the wild qualities, but the parks exist primarily for recreation and human use, whereas wilderness exists primarily for itself. So there's a category of protected area called wilderness, category 1A and 1B. And that's actually the highest level of protection. Category 1A is like, just like no humans are there at all. Things that would fall under this are like the Russian Zapovedniki system. And prior to everything that's happening right now in Russia, Russian land management agencies were doing what they could to kind of open up the Zapovedniki a little bit more to human use, but it's still highly restricted. Wild actually worked really hard to create the second category of wilderness, category 1B, and that is the category of wilderness that's inhabited by non-industrial communities. And so we absolutely have promoted a definition of wilderness that includes traditional cultures and non-industrial, non-invasive activities. Just, you know, what we want, our priority is to keep out permanent infrastructure, roads, and industrial extraction out of those areas. So there is that category. But beyond these seven categories of protected areas, I think there's a new conservation mechanism that's going to be really important in the upcoming years. And that was kind of launched at the last biodiversity COP. It's called OECMs, or other effective area-based conservation measures. And these are places where the ecology remains intact, even if the primary purpose is not conservation, but conservation values are still achieved. And through this designation, this is something where indigenous communities could designate their land as OECMs. It doesn't have to be a national government coming in and designating it and managing it. It can be managed by local communities. It can be managed by private actors. And as long as it meets these certain standards. And I'm hoping that as this evolves, and as also the idea of nature credits or biodiversity credits evolve, that the two become linked as a form of compensating indigenous stewardship and local community stewardship of the land, so that they are actually able to benefit from the services that they're providing for the rest of humanity and for the rest of life on Earth.
Hmm. Are there some countries doing better with conserving wilderness than others?
Well, I have to say I'm super impressed with Chile and Patagonia. I think that you know, there's a lot of countries that are endowed with a lot of land and a lot of wild places already. So for them, it's easy to conserve wilderness because they just haven't gotten around to exploiting it yet. But with Chile, like, I think that so many people in Chile have this, like, just this reverence for Patagonia. And Patagonia is one of the last true remaining wild places as well. And so I want to highlight Chile. I also think that in the last couple of years, Chile's done a fantastic job around the oceans. And I've seen their leadership at the UN. And I've seen how it is that they have really taken some fairly controversial but necessary stands around deep sea trawling and things like that. And so I think I have high regard for Chile. You know, and it really depends, like, how we protect wild places. There's kind of a spectrum here. And so, you know, are you engaging local communities and stakeholders? Are you empowering them to do a good job? Are you meeting spatial targets? Is the quality good? It's not just a paper park. Are you actually able to carry out what you're doing? And this is a role for local people and Indigenous peoples as well. There's so many states that don't have the capacity to put ranger patrols in all of their protected areas. And because of that, their protected areas are oftentimes, there's incursions, there's illegal logging. Having local people there who are empowered to essentially act as reporters of crime, wildlife trafficking, and illegal extraction, that is a built-in resource that we should be leveraging as opposed to trying to get rid of. But I will say, I hesitate to do this a little bit because their record with Indigenous peoples and local communities is not good. But I will say, just recently, I heard from Chinese officials and land managers that in several of their newly created national parks that are huge on the Tibetan Plateau, they are paying patrols like $300 a week, individuals $300 a week from local communities there to patrol. And I hope to see China expand that, and I hope to see more countries replicate that model, because I think that that model, operating not just with Indigenous peoples, not just with local communities, but basically empowering national populations to be a part of the solution, is the way forward.
Yeah.
Most countries are trying to achieve protecting 30% of their land area. You want to get to 50% of land and sea protected. What are some of the challenges you're finding right now in achieving those goals? Is there the political will to do that right now?
Thank you for asking this. This question has like haunted me for the last 3 years. So I think there's more and more political will. And so I want that to be the takeaway. Like, there's more and more political will. There's more and more recognition. This just has to be done. I remember even 5 or 6 years back being at pretty high level conferences and overhearing people say, "Did you hear that nature needs half stuff? That's absolutely crazy. It's totally unfeasible." My response to those people is, well, it doesn't matter if it's unfeasible or not, it's necessary. And the question is, when is it more feasible? Is it more feasible now when we have approximately half of the planet left that's intact? Or is it more feasible 30 years from now when we have 25 million more kilometers of road, when we've lost dozens of species? Like, when is it more feasible? And I think the answer is clear. It's more feasible politically and economically now. It's hard still, but it's more feasible now than it is to go back and restore at a kind of Jurassic Park scope. So yeah, I mean, the sooner we do this, the easier it's going to be. And that's the real takeaway. The sooner we get to half, the easier it's going to be. I think that the biggest challenge beyond that kind of feasibility issue is the trust with Indigenous communities. Many Indigenous communities have been removed from their land in order to create protected areas. And that can't happen anymore. And that's why I'm very excited about OECMs, and I'm very excited about the work that we're doing with Indigenous peoples, because I believe they have to be included as a major part of the solution. Additionally, what is so great about our civilization that we think that it's okay, or that it's somehow helping to remove traditional and local people from the land? I mean, yeah, like, there's absolutely issues where overuse of the land by Indigenous and local people lead to ecological catastrophe. But I don't think they're carrying the brunt of the ecological crisis that we face. That's our civilization that's doing that. So I'm very much of the opinion that it's not just a diversity and inclusion thing. Like, our civilization has to learn from other life ways. We have to remember somehow what it is we once had but lost when we lived a little bit more harmoniously with nature than we do now. And perhaps we should be looking at the values and the institutions and the ceremonies and the cultural practices of other life ways to figure out what it is we need. Protected areas are one of our culture's biggest ways of doing that. But there are other ways of living in harmony with nature as well. And we're not going to be able to turn the half of the planet into Yellowstone National Park. That's not going to happen. So we have to figure out the other tools in our toolbox that are available to us. And consulting with other life ways, I personally believe, is going to be essential for achieving that.
Are there ways in which you've introduced different life ways into your own life?
Yeah. So this is probably going to strike you as a little bit crazy, but I'm going to say it anyway. I think that ceremony plays a really important and effective role in having a better relationship with nature, both mentally but also in practice. And it's not just a woo-woo psychic spiritual thing. I think that there are social science mechanisms that we can study for how ceremony works to create a community that behaves more responsibly towards nature. Because when you engage in a ceremony, oftentimes it's public. Oftentimes, you're publicly making a commitment to others in your community and the land. So there's kind of like this embedded oversight mechanism where you know others around you are watching to see if you're going to live up to that commitment. And also, like, in Indigenous communities, like, everything is a ceremony. Like, everything is a prayer. Like, in the Yawanawa, for example, when they make clay pots, there's a ceremony for preparing to make a clay pot. There's a prayer that you say while you're making a clay pot. When you make clay pots, you can't drink water and you can't have sex, you know? And so even if you want to make a lot of clay pots, like, these conditions put on you are probably going to make you think twice about making an excess of clay pots, right? So there's kind of like natural, cultural, social speed bumps put into the use of the land because of the respect that's required in action from ceremonies. So I think ceremonies and this kind of communal thoughtfulness is key. And I want to have a wider conversation in society and in conservation, because right now we're so technical science. We think that conservation is the province of sweaty people in khakis in exotic places petting elephants, you know, and there's definitely a role for that, for the scientist and the expert. But we have to start engaging communities on a daily basis in conservation. And I wonder how it is we can use ceremony, like secular versions of ceremony even, to do that and to strengthen the bonds between ourselves and the natural world.
But today is World Rewilding Day. And I guess the main theme is hope into action. What gives you hope?
Yeah, the problems are really freaking huge. I mean, and they're unprecedented. So it's definitely going to take, like, taking risks, stepping away from the banks of the river, getting into the middle of the current and taking risks. And I am so privileged to know so many amazing people, many of them unsung heroes. Many of them are doing like the most amazing things that I'm humbled by and in awe of, and nobody's singing their praises. They're not being interviewed on podcasts, but they're there and they're taking every step they can to win this fight. And so, yeah, it's people. It's people like you, Jimmy and Lily. It's people like Toshka Yawanoa and his daughter Luna and his leadership council. It's, you know, Claude Two Elk, who's, I don't know, 90 something years old, but he says the most beautiful things about, nature. And every time he speaks, I feel like hearts change about like the way that we should be interacting with the natural world. Like there's just so many people out there who are vibrating at a different level. And they're just like these shining lights that are growing brighter and are showing us the way. And so, yeah, people are the problem, but we're also the solution. And I just feel like there are so many good people out there, and they're the ones who give me hope and keep me going.
Today with us, we have Paula Lopez. She's a reporter who recently wrote for our most recent edition of the Patagon Journal. Hi, Paula. It's so great to have you here today.
Hello, Victoria. For me, it's the same. Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me here.
So, Paula, you recently wrote about the gauchos of Aysén and the culture that exists there. And so, you know, before we kind of dive into what your process was like on that story, can you tell me a little bit about just what that article was about?
Okay, sure. Well, this article, which was published in the last issue of Patagon Journal, it was about the gaucho culture, specifically in the region of Aysén. The gaucho culture is much more larger than that region of Chile. Actually, it goes from, it is in Uruguay, in Argentina, in the whole Patagonia. But in the Aysén region, there are a lot of traditions that, for different reasons that you can read in the article, this culture started to weaken, to be lost. And there is a recent culture of young people from there who are starting different events and initiatives to reactivate this culture. And it's a very beautiful thing because you can really see how the ancient people, people for rural sites are now connecting with young people who are really want to get back to those traditions. They don't want this to get lost. And there is a continuity in the history of this region. I am sure there are a lot of other initiatives that you can get to know in the region of Magallanes, in the southernmost part of Chile, of course, in Argentina. But the tradition of the horse riding or being riding at horses for long periods of time at any time of the year, it is something that you can really experience in this region of Aysén, which specifically is the Pampa.
So for people who aren't from Chile or who aren't familiar with what changes are going on in the region, you know, how would you explain what's happening and why what Aysén Somos is doing is important?
Mm-hmm. There are many things happening. You have in first instance that Aysén is a region that made itself because of the work with the wood, with the forest, having wood from the forest, also the animals, you know, cows, sheep, the wool they would obtain from the sheep. But all of those resources, they are not anymore what they used to be, in the sense that the value, the price of the wool has gone really low. And now having animals is very, very expensive. Besides that, there's a recent phenomenon of the real estate, the loteos, the parcelamiento. How would you say
like,
that?
Yeah,
in
like the land parcels, essentially.
Yeah, the land parcels, which. It is very, very impressive and terrible at the same way, because you have to think that having a lot of sheep or animals, you need big spaces, big territory. And all of a sudden, you're having all of this land parceled in little squares, you know, and a lot of people from the city is going to live to these places in the countryside in Aysén. which has make life much more expensive for the people who has lived there forever. And a lot of people also, they see, well, my ships are not valuable anymore. I'm selling them, I'm selling my land for a little price, and they're going to the city. And so the culture of the sheep, of the gaucho, of taking the animals from one land to the other is actually disappeared in a certain way. So that's the context that worried people like the Aysén Somos, which are Javier Galilea and Francisca Stock, the ones who I interview and I go with her in this horse journey. But at the same time, you see that even if the economical thing is not affordable for them now, the tradition is much more deeper or much more powerful, and there are ways to maintain and to keep these traditions, even if their economic thing is main thing is not the sheep. So tourism in that context has been a very important economical resource that in a certain way has replaced the work with sheep or the wool, or for example the estancias. How do you say estancias? The
ranches, I guess.
Yeah,
it would be
where the big ranches, maybe they have now they have smaller amounts of sheep, but they keep it and they keep the ranch itself with all of the facilities so they can receive tourists or people from the United States or from other parts of Chile or the world and show them how this worked in a smaller scale. And they can still tell the story and you can really live that culture mostly in the same way it used to be 10 years ago, because it's something very recent and it's still happening, it's still transforming. And also I would say something that the idea or the fantasy that sailing or going away from the countryside to the city, now the people is seeing, okay, this is not what I thought, and they're trying at the same time to come back to their traditions, to what they lived. So we are in a very interesting time and a very beautiful time to go to Patagonia and see what's going on, and you can talk to these people and they're really welcome and warm. So I would say that's the context that is happening right now.
So I always like to ask, you know, was there anything that you did not include in your story that you still think is interesting or funny or unique from your experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, all of the small stories or the games, all of the things that happens after the horse riding are amazing. You cannot tell. It's mostly something that happens in secret, you know. So it's something that you cannot just write or tell, it's something that you have to experience. So that's like also my invitation. Come visit Aysén, take this journey. I know the guys from Aysén Somos are doing another horse ride in this summer. I mean, in January or February, those months in Chile. And all of the things that happen after every day in the horse ride with the fire, with the meat, with the playing the truco, with the rope game. It's something that you just can't replicate. You have to leave it.
Yeah, absolutely. And can we sort of go back to? Can you describe just what the environment was like while you were on this trip?
Well, in short words, I would say it's like experiencing the four seasons in an hour. So we started with a very, very cold day. It was autumn. It was fall, but the temperature was already very low. Actually, we were supposed to do another journey, but because of a snowfall and the big winds that appear, we had to do something that was going on the lowlands. And all of a sudden we're riding very, very cold, and the sun appears, and you see all of the ranch, all of the animals in hundreds of kilometers away, and then a cloud appears and it starts to rain again, and the wind appears, and it's very cold. So it's like really being another planet. And part of it is being cold and being warm, like feeling everything, all of the senses in your body, and feeling the horse is living Patagonia also.
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, Paula. Those were sort of all the questions that I had for you. Is there anything else that you wanted to share about this story or, you know, your experience?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me for this issue of Patagon Journal. I really invite you to read the article, to read the magazine. It's beautiful. And also to, of course, come to Patagonia. And there's so much to offer, to see and to experience.
Published in print and digital since 2011, Patagon Journal is a bilingual magazine in English and Spanish about Patagonia and the world's last wild places. Head to our website, patagonjournal.com, where you can find our magazine and read our online articles. To subscribe, support our work through our special premium membership program, or buy back issues, merch and more, visit our online store at patagonstore.com. Any suggestions or to contribute stories to the magazine, get in touch with us by email at editors@patagonjournal.com.